Let me just real quick review a few things and then get into the lesson for today. And, you know, each of these lessons, this is a 30 plus hour course that I put together some years ago, a series of lectures that I did on the heels of having just completed some theological studies. And the reason why it was so significant for me was because I found that in my own experience, and I find this to be true, generally speaking, across the board among most Christians that I've met around the world, not just here in America, is that most people don't have a good grasp on how the overarching meta-narrative, or if you will, the overarching story of redemption, how it fits together, how the pieces fit together. And probably the linchpin of this misconception is the popular notion that the primary hope of the New Testament is to go to heaven when you die. And that is simply not true. That is not what the Bible teaches. But what people don't realize is, you know, what God intended in the beginning, and then how God goes through this process to recover what was lost as a consequence of human rebellion. And so, in teaching that material then, after having done a bunch of research, as a follow-up to some of the things that I had been introduced to, working on the degree, I put this course together, and I've tried to reduce it down to a level that, could fit into four lessons. So you can imagine, you know, how we're just barely skipping along the surface, and I've tried to grab out a few things anyway that stood out to me that maybe are not necessarily all the most important things, but they tended to be sometimes the things that were outside the customary knowledge base of the average Christian on the ground. And that's why they're included in the notes that you have. Among them are the first point that was brought up in Lesson 1 having to do with the image of God. And the image of God is really important, and I don't know how significantly that was taught, how much emphasis, you know, was given 2 weeks ago when I was not here. It is extraordinarily important. And the qualities that were associated with the divine image in the ancient world, which of course was the intellectual backdrop or the cognitive backdrop to how the Israelites would have understood this message that was being given to them, that humans, according to God's verbal revelation, were created in his image. That is a big stinking deal. And the rebellion that took place, and I prefer to call it a rebellion as opposed to a fall. A fall sounds almost somewhat innocent and perhaps, you know, accidental. But what really happened was a rebellion. That rebellion damaged the image. And ever since then, part of what God is after is to recover and to restore that image in humanity. None of us are what we're supposed to be. And the way that the biblical story unfolds, of course, is that the only person then who comes along in all of human history that bears that image properly is none other than Jesus. And the Bible tells us that as a consequence of both his life and his atoning sacrifice, and then subsequent resurrection and ascension, that what will happen is that God has guaranteed that that image will be restored in us. And in the language of the New Testament, it's already there in seed form, if you will, in a measure. But then as time goes by in this life, we're supposed to be in a collaborative effort with God to restore that image experientially. And then eventually when Jesus returns, that image will be completely restored. That image involves not merely the condition of the soul, but also the condition of the body. Immortality. Physical immortality. And so that's a big deal. But even that's not the end of the story. And relationship with God is not the only part of the story. A lot of times popular teaching on the ground tells us that it's all about simply having your relationship with God restored. Well, no, that's not true. When God created humans, he didn't create us just to sit around and talk all the time with him. There was a mission. And in fact, the interesting thing is that what the presupposition of the mission, that creation mandate, as a lot of scholars refer to it, and that was covered in the first lesson, by engaging in that mandate, we would discover things about God. Because God reveals Himself through a variety of means, and the creation itself was designed to be inhabited with His presence and for His glory and His nature to actually be revealed through the creation itself. And so our engagement in the mission would have both been fulfilling. We're designed for it so that we actually have a sense of fulfillment and fullness when we engage in the mission. But also we would have discovered things then about God, about ourselves, and of course about the world that He had created. And so all of that was what the setup was in the beginning. This earth was always intended to be our home. And that's why when we come to the New Testament doesn't talk about us so much inheriting heaven as it does inheriting the earth after the earth is renewed and transformed. What does it say in the Beatitudes? The meek shall inherit what? The earth. Yeah, so Jesus is coming back from heaven, and maybe to take it one step further is that what Jesus is ultimately going to do is He's going to break down what at present is this barrier between heaven and earth. And the picture you get, of course, in the end of Revelation is where the barrier is removed. The city which God has prepared in heaven comes down to earth, and the God-man, who is Himself a permanent joining of the divine and the human, and of the domains of heaven and earth, that man is prototypical of what our future is. He's the paragon. He's the forerunner. He's the template of what's going to happen, not only to us, but to the creation as a whole. That all sin is going to be eradicated. We're going to enjoy a state of immortality and eternality. And there'll be no longer any barrier or division between heaven and earth or between God and man. But we will be filled with the full measure collectively of deity, as Paul refers to in Ephesians chapter 3 when he prays the prayer that together we might be filled up with the fullness of God. So God is involved then, ever since the rebellion, He's been involved in this recovery project, and that's what the Old Testament is all about. It begins with God then beginning to work with a particular line of people. He calls Abraham. Abraham has a special role kind of in the first place where God makes a covenant with him, talks to him about the future, and about how what God is going to do through Abraham is going to result in the nations, the peoples of the world being restored back to God and being blessed by Him. Abraham within the ancient Jewish literature is actually viewed as a second Adam. Not physically, but spiritually, functionally, in terms of recovering God's purpose. Israel then is viewed as dwelling in a land that is compared to Eden. The Garden of Eden. Just as Eden was supposed to be a launching point, if you will, this place that had been cultivated by God Himself in a world that is described as good but overall as wild and uncultivated, God has taken a small part of it and has cultivated it Himself. So that it functions, and I don't have time to unpack this, but it functions in what would be understood in the ancient world as being a parallel or synonymous with temple gardens. Because in the ancient world, they would have these various temple complexes among the various societies of the ancient Near East, and quite often they would have these gardens that would be right around the central locale of the temple where the idol or the statue of the deity would be placed. And they would be these places of fertility and beauty and all the rest of that. Eden, of course, is a word in Hebrew that means luxury, anything that's delightful to the senses. And so you have this beautiful place that's designed for humanity to, first of all, learn, grow, and develop a relationship with God and with one another and with the world around them. And then from there, they were supposed to go out into the good but wild world and to take what they had learned in that garden and begin to then, without God necessarily telling them every single detail, they were supposed to go discover things. There's this whole motif that runs through the Bible of God working with humanity in a progressive fashion where it's actually our glory to participate in the discovery of things, to explore things, to learn things, and then to proactively cultivate things in such a manner as to bring glory to God. But of course, all of that was thrown into disarray as a consequence of the rebellion. But as I said, Abraham picks up this important role. Israel carries it out. They were never intended to be an end unto themselves. They were always a means to an end. That doesn't mean that God didn't value them, but he valued them and intended to use them to reach the rest of the world. The great statement, the purpose statement, when God touches down on the top of Sinai before the law is given and God communicates with Moses, he says that he wants the whole nation of Israel to be a kingdom of priests, not just an Aaronic priesthood. He wanted the whole nation to be a kingdom of priests. And the idea was, of course, is that as a priest would function as a mediator. A priest had the role of knowing the mind of God through the law, which, of course, was an inherent or intrinsic attribute of what it meant to be an image in the first place back in the ancient world. An image was supposed to be the carrier of the presence and the glory of a deity and capable of knowing the mind and the will of that deity and then being able to mediate that out to those who would come and engage with the image. That was the idea in the ancient world. And so now Israel is picking up that role again of being supposedly, at least in a measure, bearing the image of God and functioning in this mediatorial role on behalf of the nations. When you read through the Mosaic Covenant, what you find is that over and over and over again, God says that he wants to bless Israel, not so as to spite the nations, but rather to attract the nations to himself. So that they might see that the glory of the God of Israel is so great, and they too might perhaps inquire as to how they might enter into a relationship with God. When they came up out of Egypt in the Exodus, the Bible tells us that it wasn't just the Israelites who went, but it says that there was a great throng, one translation says, a great multitude of people from other ethnicities and nationalities who came up with them, who from the beginning were part of Israel. And so all through the Mosaic Covenant, what you find is that God very much wants Israel to be a means to reaching the nations and bringing people into a restored relationship with him. As the years unfold, of course, though, we have problems in the way that Israel fails to fulfill that role, and that's where we are today. And so that's what I want to take the rest of our time to talk about, is to look a little bit at least the first few kings, first couple of kings, and how they fit into the storyline. And then we're going to bounce ahead to the prophets, simply because to review the long history of all of the kings of the northern and southern kingdoms is a bit tedious and time-consuming, and we can make a few general comments instead, which will adequately suffice to convey the basic important points. All right, so let's look at page one on the background. Y'all with me? Everybody there? Alright, so the Exodus generation of Israel was forbidden by God to enter the promised land due to their sin. Joshua succeeded Moses and led Israel into the land, but was unable to drive all of the reprobate inhabitants out. From the time of the generation after him until the time of David, Israel languished through a repeating cycle. And you find this particularly in the book of Judges. First, what happens is they begin to forget their Creator and Redeemer. Oh, maybe they remember him in name, but not in true relationship, not in obedience. They engage as a consequence in major sin and idolatry. Then they're given over by God to oppression and subjugation by their enemies, which in turn leads to them crying out to God for deliverance. And then finally, God responding and delivering them through an Israelite champion. And then there'd be a relatively brief period where things would go well again because, you know, they'd just been chastised. So, you know, it's like a disobedient child that goes back again and again and does the wrong thing. But, you know, when they first get punished for a little while there, they kind of behave themselves. So anyway, this cycle actually repeated itself for hundreds of years. You know, when I was reviewing that this morning, early this morning, I paused on that for a second. I thought, that's all they knew. You know, you can live a whole lifetime, and it can be in a small sliver of history, and you don't understand sometimes why things are the way they are, but you're just a small little life. Don't forget that. You're part of something that has been going on for a long, long, long time. And wherever we're at in the storyline of history and the unfolding saga of God's active involvement in redeeming His creation and humanity in particular, our lifetime is not the final chapter. There's more that will be done. There's more that God will do. And from the vantage point of someday in the future, after Christ returns and creation has been restored, we've been fully redeemed, and we're into it, let's just say, for 100,000 years into it. Can you imagine? And you think back on the short little time you're on this earth. It kind of puts things in perspective. So eventually what happened, though, is as Israel went through this repeated cycle, and for such a long time, I mean, you can understand after a while they grew weary of it all, even though they're their own nemesis, they're the cause of their problems. They cried out for a permanent king to deliver them from their enemies. In other words, we don't want to go back through this over and over again. But the problem was, under David there, number one, their demand for a king was essentially a rejection of Yahweh as their king. This is what the scriptures tell us. And what the Bible doesn't tell us, but what we learn from ancient Near Eastern scholars, because of all the work that they do, is that in the ancient Near East, and of course that would be Mesopotamia, you know, running from, I don't know if you know your geography, but that would be like Egypt and then pushing up, yeah, all the way up into Iraq, part of Turkey where the Hittites were, and then over into the Persian Gulf where even Iran is. That whole region, that big area, at this time in history, the overwhelming majority of the cultures and societies viewed their king as the custodian and guardian of the stability of the cosmos. Now, that might seem strange to us, but given the way that the worldviews developed in the ancient world, this was an interlocking piece that was part of the overall way in which they understood the world, the various deities that existed and so on. And so the great danger then in Israel asking for a human king, where the only model that they have for kingship or monarchy anywhere around them is that those kings always represented pagan deities. Well, the problem is that, you know, they could potentially run into this danger themselves, particularly if they're understanding and knowledge and view of God was skewed, it could become even more skewed depending on who the king was that they selected. Well, God acquiesced to their demand, and Saul was the first one who was set up as king, but of course he failed to honor God, and so it was taken away from him and given to David. Now, David's an interesting character, very important. He, as the heading up above says, he was an idealized king. If he was a church pastor today, he would be a scandal, and he would be driven out of his pastorate and position because of all of the social media and everything that would happen. After all, he was a deliberate adulterer, but worse than that, he was actively involved. In fact, he's the one who precipitated the conspiracy to have a particular man who murdered the husband of the woman that David had gotten pregnant. But worse than that, not just the husband died, but in the way that it was arranged, numerous other innocent soldiers who are sacrificing for the sake of the nation and are loyal to him as king, they get killed as well. So he's actually responsible for the deaths of quite a number of people. And so, nevertheless, because of other qualities that he had in his life, he's held up as an idealized king. It's quite ironic that the best king out of all of Israel's history is an adulterer and a murderer.
Conspirator.
Yeah, a conspirator to murder. He didn't actually pull the trigger, as we would say. He's also the progenitor of Christ, meaning, in other words, that the Messiah came through his lineage. And this is the one that I'm mostly interested in for pushing the story along, is that he functions as a type of Christ. In other words, there are qualities in his life that are a foreshadowing of the qualities that the prophets would later say would be central to the Messiah figure that God would send to redeem the world. And particularly from their perspective, to redeem Israel. So, yeah.
Yeah, I've been for over 10 years now, this question of the fact that God said the man after God's heart has troubled me when I put that together with what you just said.
Yes.
And I've been trying to figure out why did God at that time even allow him not to foresee the consequences of the adultery.
Yeah.
To the point that I don't know. If somebody who is not a Christian, who doesn't listen to God read the passage, you would take God for, let's say, any human, like,
yeah,
somebody who doesn't listen. And up to now, I'm still struggling with that.
Yeah, so the question is why did God not allow David to foresee the consequences of what his actions would be by engaging in adultery? The answer is he actually already did through the Mosaic Law. So one of the things that we have to keep in mind is that the Mosaic Law is God's binding covenant with the nation of Israel. The kings were actually required to make a handwritten personal copy of the law so that in the process they might become familiar with every aspect of the entire covenant. And that covenant is furthermore the basis of all of the functioning and future messages of all of the prophets. The prophets actually don't introduce I'll overstate it just slightly to make a point. The prophets actually introduce nothing new that's not already in the Mosaic Covenant.
Yes.
Everything that they express is based on the Mosaic Covenant. And what they do is they use figurative and poetic language and hyperbolic language, meaning exaggerated language, to express the same things that are already in the Mosaic Law. The Mosaic Law already predicts that there'll be a greater prophet than Moses who will come. And, of course, that then is the personage that winds up being identified as, you know, an offspring of David and the Messiah, the anointed one, the suffering servant of Isaiah and his writings. What they do is, of course, add more detail in their prophecies and things like that for the future. But everything that they say is already fundamentally in the Mosaic Law. And so the warnings are already there. So are the specific warnings of what would happen to David personally and how it would all specifically play out in his life, are they already, is that revealed to David? No, of course not. But there's already a clear catalog of the history of what happened to the nations who used to occupy the land that Israel now has been given by the Lord. And there are prohibitions in the law, and there are the warnings of the judgments that will come, and all. So all of the different, really, everything he needed to know, he already knew. And so I think that, you know, part of course, the whole storyline is that one of the things that the New Testament points out is that there is no one who can actually fulfill the role that God wanted somebody to play to help get humanity back on track, to serve as the right kind of leader, as one who could help the people overcome their sin, or that even he himself could overcome his or her sin. And so all of that ultimately points to the bankruptcy of the human condition, that every one of us is been affected by the initial rebellion. And hence you have the prophecy in the Old Testament that when God looked and he saw that there was no one, you know, to intercede, he was displeased and he came himself and did it. And of course that's none other than Jesus. So, you know, I think it actually is instructive and helpful for us. Now, I feel bad for David You know, because the higher up you go in responsibility, the greater the judgment is that comes upon you for the sins that you commit. There's a certain thing about, you can sin if you're down at a low level and it's still wrong and you'll still suffer consequences for your sin, but the higher up you go, because of the influence that you have on people, God will actually hold you to a higher standard, or he will execute greater judgment, greater repercussions on you. Because of the negative impact that you have on other people. So I feel sorry for David, but I'm thankful that I can learn from what he went through. All of us, ultimately, we really do need somebody else to step in for us. Well, what are some of the things that David did that were of a positive quality that would then be the basis for why David was idealized? Well, he was known for his deep worship of God. He had a deep love for God's presence. And that just shows the mixture of our own human nature, doesn't it? I mean, that's true of all of us. I mean, we can have so many great qualities about us, and yet, in just the blink of an eye, we could do something stupid. Something very sinful and destructive. David also conquered the enemies of God's people. And think about each of these items and how they would relate to the future Messiah. But so the Messiah would have all these qualities in perfection. David had them in a good measure. David was involved in uniting God's people because, remember, they were always bickering amongst one another, even killing each other. It was a tribal society. David sought to implement God's reign as expressed through the law. He reestablished Jerusalem, which came to be known as the city of God, where God's presence dwelled in first the tabernacle, later the temple. And in all of these things and more, he foreshadowed Jesus. God promised David, this is an important covenant, just like God gave Abraham a covenant that was already looking forward to the Messiah and how through his seed all the nations, all the families of the earth would bless themselves. So also God gave David a promise how there would be an everlasting royal dynasty through his descendants. But he also warned David that if your descendants go astray, then there would be significant judgment for that. Well, of course, the future kings and the nation did turn away, and that eventually led to the Babylonian exile. Even earlier, of course, the nation split in two, with the northern kingdom retaining the title of Israel, and every single one of their kings was bad. There was one who was maybe marginally good, but really a careful analysis of his life actually winds up putting him in the category of not being righteous either. The southern kingdom had a mixture. They had some good kings, but for the most part, they had evil kings. And every one of the good kings is flawed. When you read about their lives, there's not a single one without flaw. You find sin in every single one of their lives, various kinds of sin. And so eventually what happens, of course, is that the temple and the nation are destroyed. When I reflected upon it, I don't know if I got this from somewhere else or if I coined it, but I've been able to identify and categorize every single one of the sins that are cataloged in the Bible and ascribed to Israel or Judah as falling under one of three categories. Or sometimes, of course, they fall under more than one category, and they're listed there. They all begin with I. Idolatry, immorality, and injustice. Immorality is meant to be understood not merely as sexual immorality, but rather anything that breaches the morals that are taught through the Mosaic law. But in spite of that, God foreknowing this, God prophesying this, God warning, he said that there would be a future son of David. There would be a future descendant of David. And it's interesting to watch the development of the prophecy, because it's perhaps hinted at the first time that God talks to David, but in subsequent inscripturated records of the prophecy has expanded to the point where instead of David being promised a perpetual dynasty through multiple generations, he's eventually promised a perpetual reign under one king, which of course flies in the face of all human experience since everybody dies. But there's a promise made that eventually there would be a descendant of David who would rule forever. and not through future offspring, but through himself. In other words, what's predicted is that somebody will come along who will have an immortal life. And when they take up the throne, they will never relinquish it again. They will always sit on that throne. Well, Solomon comes along after David. I think, I guess we still have a little bit of time. Solomon, of course, he's not a great example to follow. He's got quite a story. But in spite of that, he also is a foreshadowing of the Messiah. Because if you look at some of the things that are said about him before he goes off on his many years of backsliding, the things that are said about him actually wind up showing up in various prophecies of the Old Testament that talk about a future Messiah. So what I'm trying to point out here is that ever since the rebellion took place, and particularly since God began to work with Abraham, but even before with Noah to some degree, what you find in many of the very prominent characters of the Bible, of the Old Testament, is that God works through them in ways that brings about a temporary, partial expression of the fullness of what he eventually is going to do through the Messiah. And so they're like baby steps, if you will. Little measures of God pouring out some grace and some favor and some blessing and bringing some things about that are a prophetic foreshadowing of what he intends and has intended from the very beginning to fully bring about. And all of that has to do with recovering what was lost in the beginning, but not just going back to the way things were in the beginning, because remember, the beginning of the story is such that we barely got out of the starting blocks. You know how in races, you know, when you race, they have the starting blocks for doing the 100 meters or whatever, 100 yards. I mean, it's like the gun went off, and it's like we had a double fault. We didn't even get down the track. And so the vision that God has is not simply to restore us to a state of sinlessness and immortality and we can have a relationship with God, but it's to get on with the business that he wanted done in the first place. And that is that the whole earth would be filled with his glory. And then from there, who knows? Maybe, just maybe, what Eden was supposed to be to the rest of the world, a launching pad to from which to go and change the whole world. Maybe this earth is the launching pad into the rest of the universe for how God wants us to eventually fill all of creation, not just this part of the creation, with his glory through us being and expressing what it means to be the image of God. So Solomon, let's look at some of the things that he does that I think are a foreshadowing of what is predicted about the Messiah. First bullet under one there is he subdued his enemies. He established his throne. Jesus, of course, does that. He did that spiritually with his first coming. But he will do that actually physically, concretely, in this world with his second coming. He possessed supernatural wisdom to lead God's people. He built God's temple according to God's plan. Of course, that's what Jesus is doing. He's actually still involved in that right now. We get to be co-participants with him. Paul referred to himself as being a master architectone, is the Greek word. And the idea there is that he is a co-laborer with Christ in helping build God's temple. And then, of course, Solomon's glorious reign benefited the people of God. And that's what we're going to see in the future. Some of the things there under number two that flesh this out a little further. Solomon reigned over the full extent of God's promised borders for Israel, even as Jesus will one day reign over the whole earth. So God gave Abraham a promise as to the land he would inherit. Abraham dies, he never receives that. In fact, he hardly owns anything when he's dead. Sometimes some of the promises that God gives you won't be fulfilled until your children's lives are lived out. Unless, of course, Jesus comes back sooner. And then there's further promises given in the Mosaic Law. Joshua goes in, they never take the whole land. David does a great job, but he basically barely accomplishes what needed to be done to possess the full boundaries of the borders of what God had promised to give Israel, and then he dies. So Solomon is the one who steps into that. God's people under his reign, second bullet under two, were numerous, prosperous, happy, and safe, just as redeemed humanity will be when Christ governs the earth and all wars and sorrows cease. And the Bible says that all the kings of the earth sought to hear Solomon's wisdom. Well, that'll be true when Christ returns as well. Scripture says, furthermore, that we will rule and reign with him over the renewed earth, which is a great promise. Some of us will be put in charge of cities, if you haven't read the parable yet. Well, moving on from David and Solomon, let's just talk a little bit about the prophets, and we're going to sum up the kings very briefly. And what we're going to do as we finish now is we're going to be setting the stage for next week when we talk about Jesus, his first and second comings, and then what does that mean for us today. On page 3 at the top there, talking about the prophets, and you can see the dates that they were primarily active. Of course, Moses is referred to as a prophet. Enoch is referred to as a prophet in so many words in the New Testament. But we're talking especially about the inscripturated prophets. In other words, the prophets whose oracles and sayings were written down and then preserved and understood to be inspired by the Holy Spirit so that they became part of our Old Testament. It says, after the reign of Solomon, Israel split into the kingdoms of Israel, which was in the north, and Judah in the south. The majority of the kings of both realms did evil in the eyes of God. And so in response, God sent prophets to speak to the kings and to the people of both nations. The northern prophets ministered primarily during the 40 years prior to Israel's fall in 722 before Christ to Assyria. And if you are in a mood where you want to listen to blues music and just get depressed, then you should read those prophets because they're almost all full of a negative outlook. Because they're within 40 years of the northern kingdom being completely destroyed by the Assyrians. And they were a brutal, brutal people. They're perhaps somewhat akin to what ISIS was here a number of years ago in the way that they were spreading in the Middle East, the way that they carried out their business. And the southern prophets ministered primarily during the 100 years prior to Judah's fall in 586. They're a little bit more optimistic. At least they include not only all of the ominous warnings of the destruction that's going to happen as a consequence of God judging Judah for its sin, but they also carry a number of hopeful oracles with regard to the future after the waves of judgment will fall upon Israel. Their primary function, number one, was to enforce the Mosaic Covenant. So if you look at the overall bulk of what is written by the prophets, they're not predicting stuff about today or about when Jesus returns or even about Jesus coming the first time. There are passages that touch on Jesus' first and second comings, although you wouldn't know it just from reading it. If we didn't have the New Testament and we didn't already have Jesus come into this world, you never would be able to tell, oh, well, the Messiah is going to come on two separate occasions, and these belong to the first one, these belong to the second one. There's no way of knowing that. It is not clear in the way that the prophecies are given. But nevertheless, they're there. And so, as they talk to the people about enforcing the Mosaic Covenant, they do three things. They, number one, remind the people of the past, the covenant, what God has done, their responsibilities to God, the goodness of God, so on, and how God's desire is to bless them. Secondly, they talk to them about the present situation in which they're in, which is, of course, not good because they've been sinning in those three categories of idolatry, immorality, and injustice. And as a consequence, they're warning them, if they continue, that just as Moses had already said, that all of those waves of judgment that are outlined in the Mosaic Law will come upon them. But then there's a third element to their prophesying, and that's they're talking to the future about how God is going to, nevertheless, at some point, for His own sake, not because they're worthy, not because they're deserving, but God, for His own sake, for His own glory, for His own purposes, And those purposes involve not simply glorifying himself as though he's some sort of, divine megalomaniac, but rather out of concern for the welfare of the nations. Because remember, Israel was never chosen to be an end in and of themselves. They were always chosen so that God might redeem the nations through them. And so part of his anger is not merely over the fact that they themselves are rebelling against him and damaging their relationship with God so that they themselves suffer, but it's that the consequence of that is that the nations are still then being kept out of God's redemptive experience. And God doesn't want to wait century after century after century after century before salvation finally comes to the Gentiles on a large scale. And so here I've got them listed as blessing, judgment, restoration. And so let's look at the restoration bullet there under number 2 on page 3 at the bottom. The subpoint there says, after the fall of Judah, the prophets often speak of God restoring the people to himself and to the land, and then also of the restoration of God's covenant of blessings. One of the subpoints is that God promises to renew his people. So the people themselves will be renewed. He's going to give them a new heart to know him. He's going to make a new covenant with them, whereby he takes his law and puts it in their minds and writes it upon their hearts. And of course, that's the living word imparted to us through the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit plays that role. And he will cleanse his people and put his spirit in them to move them to obey him, which in turn will cause the nations to come to know God. That is a very clear prediction of the new covenant, which is effected through Jesus Christ. He also promises to rule the nations. And again, this is important. So, too often, the average Christian today thinks of salvation almost exclusively in personal terms. I am saved. I am forgiven. I have a relationship with God. I'm going to heaven when I die. You can have the same thing as me. God has a vision of salvation and redemption that is so broad and comprehensive that it extends to every aspect of society. Every aspect of human experience, from top to bottom, everything that we do. So that his vision is that one day the entire human experience would be summarized with the Hebrew word that is often translated simply with the word peace. It's the word shalom, but which means much more than that. If you actually look at how the word is used and in the various contexts, it talks about a total, whole state of well-being. That every aspect of the human experience is experiencing the blessing of God. And that's God's vision. And that vision is to bring into full expression here on this earth what is already the case in heaven. And so getting ahead of ourselves, that's why Jesus told us to pray on a daily basis, your name be honored, right? Hallowed be thy name. And in the Greek, it literally means be set apart or be sanctified or be made holy, your name. And then it says, come, your kingdom, in the Greek. And then it says, be done, your will. And then it has a phrase, as in heaven, also on earth, is the Greek. And because of the parallel structure of the Lord's Prayer, it means all three. In other words, right now, God's name is already set apart as holy, it's honored, it's regarded with respect, and God has the ultimate highest place up in heaven among all of the creatures that exist there, whoever and whatever they are. And his kingdom, of course, is without opposition in heaven. Satan's been kicked out. There's not one even slight resistance to the establishment of God's rule. All sentient creatures in heaven right now gladly, joyfully submit to the rule of God and derive great personal and social benefit from that. And then thirdly, his will is perfectly executed by every single moral agent that is in heaven. And God says, Jesus says, just like that is up there, I want that down here on this earth. That's what I wanted in the beginning. That's what I purposed to take place. And that's what will come to pass. I have guaranteed it. I have already championed over all the forces and powers of evil. I have forgiven you your sin. Stand in the place of righteousness. Pray this prayer and live this out because it's going to come to pass. That's the vision. And in the Old Testament, that vision is already there. That's not just a New Testament, new fanciful idea. When you read the prophets, they talk about what the world will be like when the Messiah comes. And so this is what God was communicating through the prophets. It says that God would raise up, these are the subpoints on number four there, page four up towards the top, on God ruling the nations. God would raise up a Davidic ruler to slay the wicked, subdue God's enemies, render justice for the poor, and restore God's people who are in exile. His servant would bring God's salvation to the ends of the earth, and God's justice to the nations. God's reign will be celebrated and proclaimed among the nations, and it says that His reign will be characterized by peace extending from Jerusalem to all nations. I mean, what a vision! What a vision! Imagine this whole globe. No more war. Can you imagine that? No more bad news. Can you imagine that? No more hate. No more sin of any kind. Nobody speaking sin. Nobody thinking sin. Nobody wanting to commit sin. No more disease. Immortality. Strength, life, power, joy, creativity. Can you imagine the whole earth full of that? It almost sounds like some fantasy movie. Sounds like some kid's storybook, a fable. But that's the storyline of the Bible. That's what God says He's going to do. And so, by the time Jesus comes, if you look at all the different prophets, so they're functioning again for a couple hundred years or so, a little bit more. And if you take the bits and pieces out of each of the prophets that we have in our Old Testament, every single one of them that looks forward to this future age, and you begin to analyze them, see the similarities. A lot of things that are said, you know, are parallel, just sometimes expressed slightly differently. I made a list. I took a 3-year period where I had gone through the Bible and for my devotions instead of doing the routine thing. I was actually hunting down all this stuff from all of the New Testament and the Old Testament as well. And so I compiled it all and you know, incorporated it into different parts of this course. But take a look at this. What some of the things that are said about, what the Jewish people who were informed in the Scriptures, what they were looking for based on what was promised by the Old Testament prophets. So first of all here, that there would be the servant of Yahweh, servant of God, servant of Israel's God, that Isaiah talks about, and God would give him as a covenant to bring salvation to His people and to the nations. That's pretty profound right there. The man is the covenant. It's not a piece of paper. It's not law written on stone. The man himself is the basis of the covenant. There would be a coming of a messianic Davidic warrior king, like a Joshua or like a David. So that's why they had some expectation of a violent Messiah. And you know what? He actually is violent. Not all violence is bad. When He comes again the second time, the Bible tells us that He's going to execute violence on the wicked. But if you think of the wicked as being people who are doing some of the horrible things that are going on today. I mean, I just heard of a situation here recently where somebody was trying to sell their baby. And of course, you know what happens sometimes. I know of one guy in our church. He's now over on the mission field again. But he was involved in working with U.S. Special Forces who were hired by foreign governments to intercept people who are involved in sex trafficking, where people would in some cases actually be put to death live for the video cameras as part of the sexual fulfillment of perverse rich businessmen from the West. People like that should be put to death. They should be put to death. And Jesus is going to put people to death when he comes a second time. There's the gathering of the scattered people of God, the purging, cleansing, and blessing of God's people and the land, the overthrow of foreign pagan oppression, the establishment of God's true temple, the subduing of God's enemies and the judgment of the nations, the establishment of God's kingdom worldwide from Jerusalem, the blessing of the nations, peace, prosperity, and the worship of Yahweh, the outpouring of God's Spirit upon all flesh, and then finally, the big kicker, the resurrection of the righteous and the unrighteous for the purpose of judgment on evil and reward for good, and last but not least, the renewal of the creation itself, the actual physical creation. All of that is already in the Old Testament. So when you take all of those prophecies and you begin to ponder, I mean, this is revolutionary. This is not just for Israel's benefit. This is for the whole world. And God promises that though there is great evil in the world, and even though each of us is stained by evil and corruption, God will come, He will redeem Israel, He will redeem people from all the nations of the world. Not everyone will be redeemed, and those who are obstinately wicked and unrepentant, those He will judge, He will put to death, and He will establish peace, and there will be a universal reign all over the face of the earth, all under the authority and the kingship of this Messiah, this anointed one who is sent by God into this world. This is one of the reasons why the early disciples had a hard time kind of figuring Jesus out. Because, I mean, he comes in at a relatively low, he's kind of like under the radar. He's got a number of qualities about him that are consistent with what's been said about the Messiah, but he's not doing all this big-time stuff. He's not fighting the Romans. He's not overthrowing Herod. And so, that's one of the reasons why they had some difficulties with him. If you look here, number two, begin to wrap up and then see if you have some questions. One of the things that's interesting, if you try to go back and put yourself in the mindset of an Israelite in the first century, and you don't know who Jesus is yet, and you don't have the perspective of the New Testament documents, all you have are your prophets and everything from the Old Testament, what's been passed down orally. One of the problems is that it's a little bit like a jigsaw puzzle. As I said, these prophecies are scattered all throughout the various inscripturated prophets. And even the prophets themselves are not laid out like a textbook. You have sometimes individual oracles. They're not necessarily all connected. They don't even all show up in their individual books in chronological order in which they were first given to the prophet. The range of topics that they address can be quite broad. And so if you pick up a couple verses here, and maybe six verses here, and one verse here, and from all, how does it fit together? That wasn't spelled out. And it pleased God to do it that way. He didn't spell every detail out. So it's almost like he took a bunch of truth and he just sort of threw it up like that. Of course, there's more order to it than that. But from our perspective, that's a little bit the way that it looks when you look in the Old Testament. And so the question was, well, how's all this going to happen? And exactly, in fact, it wasn't even clear to the Jews that every single one of these prophecies all hinged on one person. Sometimes they thought it was actually more than one individual who would fulfill these things. In some cases, the reasoning was is that, oh, it's not actually a real historical individual. That is rather a literary figure of speech functioning in a symbolic way, talking about the remnant. In other words, a group of people who have separated themselves from the larger number of Israelites or Jews because the rest of them aren't really radical for God. It's going to be us. And because of our dedication, because of our sacrifice, because of our righteousness, God then is going to precipitate these things and He's going to use us to do it. And so there were a variety of opinions that were floating around in the first century. In a very brief fashion, I've captured this here in number two. And so here's some things that they believe. First of all, almost all of them, well, as far as we know, there's no exception to this. Every Jew, so far as we understand it, that was looking for God to intervene and fulfill these great prophecies of the Old Testament, believed that it would happen in a relatively short time frame, probably one generation. The reason is because all their examples previously in history happened that way. You have Joshua succeeding with most of his endeavors in one generation, David succeeding in one generation, and even an individual who's not recorded in our scripture but is only alluded to symbolically, Judas Maccabees. This is in the intertestamental period. Judas accomplished a lot within one lifespan as well. And so the precedent, the pattern from their own history suggested, well, when God acts to intervene and his man comes on the scene, it's going to happen probably within a few decades' time. And that's part of the reason why, after Jesus was raised from the dead in Acts chapter 1, remember, they said to him, is it at this time that you're going to restore the kingdom to Israel? Jesus didn't say, oh, your theology is all wrong. No, he just said, no, it's not for you to know when. It is going to happen, but it's not for you to know when. They thought, okay, first they thought the whole thing was, of course, trashed when they saw Jesus die. They thought, you know, well, if he's the Messiah, now he's dead, how can he fulfill any of this, so it's all over. Guess we were wrong. But after he rises from the dead, their hopes are raised again. But as their hopes are raised, they think it's going to happen, you know, well, now, of course, right? Now. And the answer, of course, is it's not for you to know. And here we are 2,000 years later. Who would have thought, right? And the other thing was, is how would this be fulfilled? What would precipitate God moving to fulfill all these prophecies? So the Pharisees developed in the intertestamental period, and basically the storyline is they believed correctly that because the people of God kept violating the Mosaic law, that the way to help guarantee that God is going to fulfill his promises is that we have to be deserving of it. The way that we're to be deserving of it is to keep the Mosaic law. But the Mosaic law was written for our ancestors who lived a long, long time ago, 1,000 years before. Think about it, 1,000 years. That's a big difference in time, different context, different culture even. And so what they did is they took that law and they multiplied rules for how to apply the law in their contemporary day. And so the law went from its original list of 633 commands to now having thousands and thousands and thousands of rules of application as they tried to be faithful to keep the law. So their intention was good if nevertheless misguided. So they thought that by observing all of the rules that humans had postulated were the right way to apply the Mosaic law, they thought that, by maintaining that standard of righteousness, that would invite God to come and then begin to act to fulfill his prophecies. The Essenes were a group that are not mentioned in the Bible, but we think there's some allusions there due to the historical data that we have from archaeological sources. They withdrew and they went off and lived out in the wilderness. They created communities out in the wilderness. They're connected with the Dead Sea Scroll discoveries, as you may have heard about before. And they basically pursued righteousness in large part on the supposition of what holiness looks like, and that is to withdraw from society altogether. Society is so corrupt, including the temple system, that we have to establish our own subculture, our own society. And, of course, Christians have done these things through the years, too. We multiply our own rules for what we think is righteousness within our cultural context. Some of us withdraw from society. We want nothing to do, no interaction with the world around us. And then, of course, the Zealots, because they saw that strain of prophecies that talk about the violent suppression of God's enemies, well, they sought to use violence as the means by which to precipitate God's intervention. They thought that if they would finally just show some righteous resolve and anger towards the wickedness of their foreign oppressors and would begin to revolt against them by assassinating various figures and so on, that this would be taken as a sign of passion on the part of God so that he would be pleased with their actions and then he would intervene. Sometimes you can hear that vitriol from conservative Christians today as well. Jesus, of course, doesn't fit any of these categories. He's a category unto himself. And he surprises everybody. And when he comes back the second time, he's going to surprise us all as well. But it'll be a good surprise. So I hope that helped paint the picture for you a little bit. It's real cursory. But I'm hoping that you see some of the building blocks for how this storyline, you know, unfolds. So next week I'll be with you again, I'm happy to say. And we'll talk about what Jesus accomplished with his first coming, what he will accomplish with his second coming, and then what does that mean for us today since we live in between the times, right?